don't know if anybody recalls, but that's where we were. Living generously to document the sources, that's what we're doing.
It's an overview of some of the more, here, take two, one for each, the principles of tzedakah. Here, Jay.
Yeah, I don't have one,
too. Fine. So, this was an overview, just quickly, we looked at the Rambam, because I said, during the course of our learning, we're gonna look at different Rishonim, Rambam being Maimonides, and called the Rishon. We looked at Jonathan Sacks' piece about tzedakah itself. We looked at Midrash, and we concentrated on the notion that in rabbinic literature, when we talk about tzedakah, we're really talking about righteousness in general. We're also talking about our relationship to the poor. Not a surprise, but we saw a Vayikra Rabba source that had different names for different categories of poor, either people or communities. So when we have in mind, when we say the poor, it means the poor. It means one who longs for everything because maybe he was once well-to-do and now he's not well-to-do. We talked about one who's poor of wisdom. We talked about one dispossessed of property in some legal matter. We talked about being detached from his property. Maybe he lives somewhere else now and he doesn't have anything, but he has something over there. You know, fortunes are more material in the ancient world than in our time. There's one who is crushed. He sees a thing but can't eat it. In other words, poor and really, really heartbroken about being in that state. There's one who's mach because he's lowly before everyone. And, you know, what does it mean to be mach and lowly as a poor? So then you have the weak. So there are the forgotten, the weak, the very impoverished, and what I wanted to do by going through those sources at the before Yontif kind of moment is I wanted to say that every time you just say the poor when we're talking about the Gemara, because it's going to translate it like that in the couple of pages of Bava Batra that we're going to get into tonight, we're talking a little bit more dynamically than the poor. There's lots of different categories of poor, and that also brought us to the place where we could say that we're trying to humanize, the rabbis for sure, through rabbinic literature, are trying to humanize very much the different situations of impoverished people and impoverished souls. So yes, we're talking about poverty on the level of economic poverty, but we're also talking about recognizing the differences in situations of people, whether I once had and I don't any longer, or whether the court took away from me and I've been stuck in this rut, or I really am lowly because I just socially never was able to get along and I never was able to establish a business and I was never able to establish myself within the community, or I'm really just one of the beggars at the gate. And tonight we're going to get into the beggars at the gate, but I want us to always think of, when we're looking at sources for this limud, for this learning, for this chapter of our learning, it's a little bit more dynamic than that. Okay, so different people could be represented in the poor at the gate when we are going to see that term in Bava Batra. And that's based on the Vayikra Rabba source that expanded it. So that's why we did that with the introduction. Okay. So the Dapim of the Gemara that we're going to concentrate on, from which we'll also take a little bit of a detour here and there to talk about features of the text as we have done previously, sometimes related to our subject matter, sometimes just because you can't be in a certain spot in the Gemara and encounter a certain expression or a certain character or demut or persona and not concentrate a little bit on what that person represents or that trope represents in the Gemara. So what we're going to concentrate on, as I pass around, is on Bava Batra, where there are a few pages that deal with issues of tzedakah and issues of this mitzvah. And my teacher about this was Danny Siegel. If you've heard of Danny Siegel, and at one point he ran the Ziv Tzedakah Fund, want to pay him respect of saying that this is the first person with whom I got to learn these pages was Danny Siegel, and he brought various selections from these pages in his Lloyd George apartment, Lloyd George's street in Jerusalem, and I was just beginning rabbinical studies, and I'd always heard some of these sources in English, but he was the one to really link our work, our tzedakah work. Everywhere in Israel, we traveled around different places to different tzedakahs, as he called them, different places that were doing amazing work, seeing Eisendog Center for the Blind, the Netanya Riding Club, Shalva when it was in its infancy, Yad Sara when it was just at a very different level than decades ago, all these places. Well, we would come and study with him, and then we would go out and work with all these different people, because you have to make text come alive according to the way Danny taught it. And so he's really Rebbe in that way. Text to life, limud lema'aseh, right? That's our expression. Learning to action. Limud lema'aseh. That you should learn and then put it into action. But so the pages we're going to concentrate on are 7b through some of the material on 11b. So we're going to take these particular pages because they are like a small Masechet Tzedakah, if you will. I want to put it into context first. We could just jump in with the Mishnah that is on 7b, but it's worth my just reviewing the other Mishnayot before ours in the first chapter of Bava Batra with you. Now, there are three Bavas, by the way. Right? There is Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, and Bava Batra. Those three Bavas are three gateways. Bava is a gate. And the first one means Bava Kama, the first gate. Bava Metzia, the middle gate. Bava Batra, the last gate. These three, according to most scholars, were really one big tractate. When it came time to creating Masechtot of the Gemara, like the volumes we have already, forget the fact that the art scroll is two or three volumes sometimes per Masechet, you had this split up of this Masechta that was so big into three Masechtot, and therefore you could say that Bava Batra begins with this kind of material. When you're looking for a translation of the Mishnah in and of itself without being in the art scroll, Gemara, art scroll, did create a Mishnah at a time, which is this old publication, the art scroll Mishnah series. It's bound now in a different way, and it looks different in terms of a cover. Art scroll still sells this. There's a 6-volume Judaica Press Mishnah translated by Philip Blackman that has basic footnotes on each of the Mishnayot in each of the 6 orders of the Mishnah. And Kahati, which is over there, the blue-spined books with the kind of cream or yellowish tint there you could see as the jackets are printed, that is an English translation of the great work in Hebrew by the banker Kahati, who, with his erudition as a banker in Israel, because of his wonderful education and his time as a banker, so the legend goes, to sit and learn Mishnah, really wrote a commentary. The difference there is that he gave you everything that the Talmud Bavli generally says about the Mishnah, so that he kind of says, if the Mishnah is translated like this, the Talmud explained it already like this. Blackman will not always tell you and give away what the Talmud is saying. He's kind of in the Mishnah itself. But the notes generally work to give you a hint based on either what the Talmud says or what Rabbi Bartnura, Ovadia Bartnura, says, the classical commentator on a classic Mishnah who came from Italy. And this has got extensive notes with some summaries of different commentators at the bottom. So I'm just going to go through quickly from the Blackman the Mishnayot at the beginning of Bava Kama to give you a context for where we are. In general, you could say that we're in Bava Batra. I'm sorry, not Bava Kama. Bava Batra deals with the right of sale. It deals with acquisition. It deals with ownership. It deals with possession. Transfer of real estate. Immovable property. Responsibilities and duties involved in such acquisition and possession, with the rights of hereditary succession and inheritance, legal deeds, and legal documents. So that's
very useful.
Very useful. Mishnah 1 deals with two joint holders agreed to make a partition in a courtyard. They have to build the wall in the middle. Wherever it is the local custom to build of untrimmed stones, of hewn stones, of half bricks, or bricks, they have to build it. Everything should be in accordance with local usage. So what does the ancient courtyard that they're talking about look like? What's the letter that we said, the Hebrew letter? A chet. Imagine the ancient Hebrew courtyard is like this. That courtyard in the middle of this U-shaped or chet-shaped bunch of houses, right? So in other words, there's some zoning laws around here. If we agree, then we're going to share in the cost of this thing, and we're going to do it in the aesthetic way that's been established within, at the very least, our neighborhood, if not the larger city. Mishnah 2. Likewise, also in the case of a garden held by two joint holders, wherever the local custom is to fence it in between the holdings, one is bound to do so, but in the case of a field where you grow crops that don't have as much need for kind of gardening on a, you know, I'm not a great gardener, but some people I know go out every day, and some people go out every other day, and you know, they patch you with the garden, right? So if you say that you own that kind of property, then you don't have to necessarily there's no local usage to build a fence. One is not bound to do so. But if a joint holder were minded to do so, in other words, if you have kavanah to do so and you own it jointly with somebody, you move to his own part and build the fence there and make the border mark on the outside to indicate that the fence is solely his. So there are some cases where I can build. You don't have to necessarily put up everything with me. There are some cases where I have to build, we have to build together, we have to agree to on the building materials. It has to be within the local, it has to be within the aesthetic of the local kind of building code. If a wall belonging to joint holders of a courtyard collapsed, says Mishnah 4, each of the co-owners is bound to help in the cost to rebuild it up to a height of 4 cubits. So let's say you had a real tall one, well, it breaks and it crumbles, well, you got to build it up to 4 cubits. And each is presumed to have paid unless one brings evidence to show that the other is not paid. So this is a legal process. Right, we're not in any of the materials in front of us just yet. I'm giving a little bit of background before we get to the Mishnah that is in front of us, the background of the Mishnayot and the context of Bava Batra, which we're studying, to show you that it's all about joint ownership and what you're supposed to build and how you're supposed to have a certain aesthetic and who takes responsibility for these things. But if thereafter he built another wall close to it, even though he put no roof on it, he's made to bear the share of the outlay of all, and it's presumed that he has not paid his share unless he brings evidence. So they're really interested so far in sharing costs for building projects. So Bava Batra opens up with, you should make sure that your business partnerships are kosher. Right? And we need Mishnah to really say, legislation to really say, you have to take this seriously. And obviously, if there's ways to prove that you either did pay or you didn't pay, this is the kind of adjudication that the local Beit Din would get into in order to make things fair. Okay? So that's the bottom line thus far. But then, it gets into Mishnah 5 with a little bit more than just a wall or a fence. And our Mishnah is 5. So here we go. You can go to 7b2, that's in front of you. And it's the Mishnah on page Zion Bet, if you're following in the Vilna. Okay? So the Hebrew packet is the Vilna Shas, to remind ourselves what's where. The Vilna Shas has the Gemara in the middle. So if you put your hand directly, kind of like chopped down on the middle of the page, that's the Gemara text. Because it's side two of a page, Rashi is to the left. So just page navigation here. Rashi is to the left. I'm going to refer to Rashi tonight, where Rashi, as well as the Vilna text itself, the Gemara text, has the letters Mem Tov Nun Yud. So about where the top of that gray line on the right-hand side of the column is, you can see Matnitin. That's the abbreviation for Matnitin. We taught in a Mishnah, Matnitin. And that's the Mishnah we're going to start with, and I'm going to refer to the Rashi that also is Matnitin about, I would say, 10 lines down in the narrow Rashi lines. Right? You see the same letters, Mem Tov Nun Yud? Okay, here we go. Matnitin. Yes. So go up to the top of that gray line where your finger is. Go left. No, in the Vilna text in the middle. See, Mem Tov Nun? Matnitin. That means Matnitin. It means in Aramaic, we taught in the Mishnah. That's the abbreviation for a Mishnah. But it doesn't say Mishnah, it says Matnit. Which means matnitin. It says, well, first of all, in certain Hebrew words, I can put a what's called a chupchik. This little kind of apostrophe. That chupchik is there because they figure, oh, everybody knows what's supposed to finish this word, and I, as the printer, don't need to put the three letters. And if I do if I economize on this word every time I have it in the Gemara, I'm going to save myself at least a folio.
Okay.
I got to think. I'm printing. I got to sell books. So that's one reason. And the other reason is because there's just universal ways of abbreviating. And everybody knows that this is Matnitin. We taught in the Mishnah. Okay. Yeah? Kofin oto livnot beit sha'ar v'delet. So, very strong verb. I'm in the Mishnah now. We compel or force a person, let's say, Oto. Now, you see the brackets in the English, those of you following in the English, that says an unwilling resident? See that? That's because already Art Scroll likes to accept everything that Rashi says and put it in the translation. But if we only read what the Mishnah says, which we do, we could translate it like Blackman, who says, one who dwells in a courtyard is compelled to share the cost of building the vestibule, the gatehouse, and a door for the courtyard. Right? There was no valence on the oto if I just read the Mishnah. Right? It's just kofin oto. Now, maybe the valence comes from the fact that I have the verb kofin. Except, under the law, we're compelled to follow a lot of laws here. It's not that every time we're unwilling to follow the laws, so that they force us and obligate us. Right? In legal language, I don't think you can say every time that there's a compulsion to do something that it's because someone is recalcitrant. Right? Arthur, help me out here. Right? Under the law,
yes.
Aren't there obligations and we force people to do things? Even though they're not kind of standing up and saying, no, I don't want to?
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it depends on what you mean by the word compel. Because I think it does have a connotation of applying force to get something done. And if somebody's willing, by definition, you don't need to apply force.
Yeah, but you think compel applies only to someone that is resistant?
I do. I mean,
is that true, though? I mean, aren't we compelled to do things in the building, Helene? We're forced to do them. It's not like we're not willing to do them.
It seems the word force in and of itself suggests that you have to, I mean, a force is something, is pressure put on it.
But there
someone
is.
Someone like doesn't need the pressure, you don't have to do it. So it depends on how you define the word compel here.
Ron, Meir, how do they use the word kofin in modern Hebrew?
Kofin is to force. But the way I see it, there was a law of the civil authority of in that area. And two Jews got into a fight, who will build the wall, and then it came to the Talmud to discuss it. That's the way I think it came, to be written here.
Fight
has to happen. Yeah, the law is the civil law of Babylon, you know, whatever it was, the code of the city. And one guy didn't want to do it. Voluntarily, you know, you build a house, you need to buy the code of the city.
Mm-hmm.
One guy didn't want to do it.
It's quite possible, by the way, that you're totally on to the way the mission is formed. And that it is a result of some Beit Din case, and that these were notes of how, you know, how we ultimately adjudicated as a Beit Din.
It's not biblical.
So let me ask you, what would be the word for obligated rather than compelled?
Require someone.
Require or obligated to do something.
There's a difference between compelling me to do something and requiring me to do something.
Right. Yeah. And so in Hebrew, the difference between whatever this word is and
kofin.
Yeah.
Kofin is like, I take you and I push you to do something.
Right. So we are
really... It's based in force, it's power for somebody to do something.
You're being dragged into the process.
See, I dragged into the process. I thought that's where I was trying to feed the, feed the Beit Midrash here. Fiadatit is where I was going, right? We use the term
fiadatit
to mean
future,
dragging somebody into religious the religious obligations. You know, when it comes to abiding by rabbinic law in current Israeli society for some aspect of life cycle or what have you. That's the verb that we use. We use it to say you are obligated, but in terms of its valence, sometimes it is that the individual is coerced. It's coercion. But sometimes it's simply you're required under the law to really do this. Mm-hmm. And so I think you could find it, you know, find it to be both ways. And therefore, why even parse it out to this degree? Because we want to see if this is just going to now become Bedeavad, I brought this guy to court because these other Mishnayot said you have to prove that you paid, or you didn't prove that you pay, or we have to come up with a system to ask somebody if they really did pay for their part of the wall, or they really did pay for their part of the fence, or they really did pay for the rebuilding of the fence. Well, here is a Mishnah that's going to get us into tzedakah, and I'm interested in this verb because ultimately if the legislation for tzedakah is coming out of this verb, then I'm asking myself, in a little bit of a way, and this is a parking lot question for us as we go through the sources, am I talking about actually going and shaking some tzedakah out of somebody because they didn't give according to their own willingness, or can I see that the Mishnah is going to proactively and lechatchila in Jewish law terms, Jewish legal terms, lechatchila, proactively legislate a certain requirement about tzedakah in my community to take care of those who should be taken care of. So I'm interested in what the sense of this verb is as we get into the whole question. What is he building to begin with is really the next part of the mission that we have to unpack, but we're going to keep that in the parking lot as a question in our mind as the whole legislative area of tzedakah unfolds in these pages.
But the tzedakah starts in the biblical sources from a mitzvah.
Right.
There is no mitzvah for me to erect the wall.
By the way, let's take another look over here in our parking lot. Let's park and say, how many times do the rabbis in these pages learn the mitzvah of tzedakah from the sources that you think would naturally be the anchor sources d'oraita in the Torah? And how many times are the rabbis talking in terms of basic social legislation within a community, right, about creating a system for tzedakah that doesn't necessarily seem like I'm fulfilling the different Torah verses that we've mentioned. And we mentioned these at the introduction, so we'll mention them again now. What are the basic verses that come to mind when we think about the Torah's commandment to give tzedakah? Right? I'm leaving the corners of my field. Mm-hmm. I'm not letting my brother go. I'm giving a loan with no interest. Things like this, right? Those are the anchors in Torah verses and Torah text. And then there is the question, does the tzedakah system within the rabbinic culture develop because the rabbis say, in a classic way, I have a verse from Torah, and here's how I ultimately fulfill it today, given the realities of today versus the realities my ancestors had when they were farming, or when the Torah first talked about this. Right? So that's a good question, too. And I think you'll find it enlightening to see where sometimes they do link it, and where sometimes they don't link it. Very interesting the way it comes out. Let's look at the contents of the Mishnah. So you kofino to whatever it really means. You obligate this person, probably recalcitrant, but we'll give it a little space. Look at Rashi now. Matniti, kofino to. Here is why I do say that he was refusing to play his part. Et ben ha-chatzer, if you want to follow with me, I'm at the Matnitin Rashi kofino to. Yeah. Et ben ha-chatzer, she'enu rotze l'sayeya et b'nei ha-chatzer, livnot lehen beit sha'ar, liot shomer ha-petach, yoshev sham, b'tzel, marchik et b'nei reshut ha-rabim, mil ha-tzitz b'chatzer. So it's one big long Rashi says. What's that?
No, he said he doesn't want to help.
Yeah, he doesn't want to help. So it says, the guy at Ben HaChatzer, the guy who's your neighbor, the one who lives in the courtyard with you, he doesn't want, Eino Rotze L'Sayeya, Sayeya is like Lazor, he doesn't want to help the rest of the community who lives around that courtyard to build for them the gatehouse, to have in it, and this is where we get a little bit of cultural information by Rashi, who fills it in, to have in that gatehouse, meaning I have the Beit Sha'ar, I have the little gatehouse, to have it in the gatehouse, a gate attendant,
Shomer
HaPetach, who sits there in the shady spot, so you're going to build him like a little, whatever the Beit Sha'ar is, it's this little gatehouse, right? You've seen them. It's like either three walls and a little roof, and the guy sits, or it's a full-out, protected from the elements kind of little, you know, like the closest thing that I think of when I think about these things is when you go to parking garages, and they have one person at the little gate, and they're the ones taking either the cash, the credit card, the tickets, and they open the little window. Right, so that's the kind of like little gatehouse that I'm imagining. Umarchiket b'nei reshut harabim, and they actually keep the poor of the public domain, because remember your courtyard is the private domain in this situation. So they're keeping the public
away,
the poor of the public, to be precise. They're laharchik otam, right? They keep them from milahatzitz b'chatzer, peeking into the courtyard.
So that was the rich neighborhood, gated community.
So it's your first notion of, in some ways, gated communities, or gated chatz, or gated chatzer at least, a gated courtyard.
No, but if you pay somebody to see, that's already cost money.
Yeah, so it does cost money, and by the way, on that level, here's the observation. The gated community that is described here, can you see that part? Here's going to be my question. Can you see that part as establishing a bureaucratic system where there's a job for certain people to serve as shomer, and in theory incorporate that into the quote-unquote social welfare system that you create vis-a-vis those people who would be the Reshut HaRabim people, the public people out there who would be looking into the courtyard anyway? Can I really define that shomer as
the
being otherwise
a statement.
It doesn't seem to go with the concept. The concept is to keep out the poorer people. It doesn't sound like that's
to
the same impetus to provide.
You want to take a chair, Barry, over here?
Yeah.
Move over there.
Oh, it's nice, Alex. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I mean, it seems to me as though they're more interested in protecting themselves from the poor people coming in than in providing a job for a poor person
right.
to work. It doesn't seem like the same,
but
you know.
But if you are hinting that the Shomer will be a volunteer at no charge as a social benefit and a mitzvah to give somebody a job, if you don't pay him, he's not responsible.
So I wasn't hinting that.
So you cannot have it as a tzedakah.
I wasn't hinting that. And I am asking the question in terms of the overarching sense that I get of what does it mean to build up a city? What does it mean to have different jobs in a city? Can I only see a gated community as a really negative thing? Look, I lived for a while. I went to school in Bel Air. It was a gated community up in where the American Jewish University is located. And you know, we know that they do this. The neighborhood is pristine. They keep it just beautiful. And, is it a benefit to have a whole staff there who does the groundskeeping and the guard watching and the this and the that? Does that provide to these kind of communities, one after the other, after the other, after the other, wind up providing some of the possibilities for work that are necessary within cities and within communities is an overarching question, because at the end of the day, we have to ask the question not only about how we give to the poor, but how we make provision within society for keeping people in work, right? So I'm just throwing it out there as a question.
But why you stick to the poor walking by to go in? It could be somebody who...
By the way, you're right. I pressed the translation into the poor.
Yeah, is that there?
But it's not really there.
Oh.
You're right. So I was being careful, though, to say that. I read it as poor, but I said the people in the public. Rishut harabim.
So I have a question. Does this indicate, then, that in Talmudic times they had these courtyards and these guardhouses, or that in Rashi's time?
In the Talmudic times, because in the Mishnah itself.
Right, so... But we think Rashi is interpreting that, or that actually Rashi experienced the same thing too? Because we're talking about.
I think that Rashi is passing along the understood reality of the Mishnaic time. I'm not sure what Rashi's community looked like in that sense.
So when I first heard it, I thought that this was more of a communal thing, that people live in this courthouse and that they should all chip in to make sure that it's well kept. And that it is more of a everybody taking care of a communal space, which is different than hiring someone else to come in and make sure no one else comes in. It's a whole different concept of people getting together to keep something in shape and beautiful.
Yes,
versus
like a kibbutz.
What?
In a kibbutz,
yeah,
everyone
like
shares the world.
Yeah, I like that.
Right. So, right. If you simply think about it as a benefit to society when... We've talked about Mishnayot, which is why I read you the Mishnayot at the beginning of Bava Batra here, where we all are going to chip in to make sure that we do have a nice wall and a nice partition and it's done in the right way and we're going to have someone at the gate and we're going to, you know, people shouldn't just be looking in and we're going to keep out the general public from wandering in our garden and wandering into our place, then yeah, you could see it as totally a collective investment in maintaining property and maintaining the property's value. No doubt about that. The Mishnah is going to make an issue, though, of this gateway and this delet, this doorway, when it comes to our relationship, even if we do it to beautify our place and keep it nice.
Yeah.
The Mishnah is going to make an issue, the Gemara is going to make an issue of how we relate to the poor people going by. Which is why I just didn't say the general public walking
we
by.
Should let them in.
Where do you let them stand? How do you even know if they're there? You know, do they get to talk to the shomer first? Do they get to knock on the door? Do they get to come past the first door? Do they get to then come to the gateway? The delet versus the shaar. You know, so we're going to start now hearing that that's part of the issue that comes around here, and it's not just a matter of whether or not people A are maintaining properties together in a nice way so that the community can look right, and B, whether or not everybody's paid their fair share in order to do that. we're going to now start the discussion.
So how does it relate to tzedakah?
That's
like we're veering away from tzedakah.
About to turn back into the.
No, this is tzedakah. This is a turn into the tzedakah discussion.
Okay.
The way that it's turning into a tzedakah discussion is that instead of just being like the Mishnah started, as a foray into collective responsibility of the people who share a neighborhood and a courtyard, now it's saying, oh, but certain elements of that shared obligation relate to the way we all relate to the poor people in our neighborhood. Okay, so when we force him to get involved with the building of the Beit Sha'ar, the Delet, and Rashi says about the Delet, L'Sha'ar Hechatzer, L'Na'alo, that the door is the part of the gatehouse that has a lock on it. So there is a door you also have to put in with a lock. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Lo kol chatzer reuyot levet sha'ar. But Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel teaches, but not every courtyard requires a gate. A gatehouse. So, whereas the Mishnah kind of, you might have read it and assumed that every courtyard requires a gatehouse and a door, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel comes along and tells you, remember though, not every courtyard requires this gatehouse.
So there is no argument. I don't know why we need to listen to this guy. We don't need to kofin if there is no, if it's not Ra'ui Liot Shah.
Some are.
Right. Yeah, it's just the Mishnah. It's just like the Mishnah providing law. So, in other words, there was a case when someone needed to be obligated to pay into the collective responsibility to create a gatehouse and to create the delet that goes with the gatehouse, the door that goes with the gatehouse and it has a lock on it. By the way, we have a minority opinion registered. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel just reminds everybody that not every courtyard needs a gatehouse to begin with. Period. That's a Mishnaic style. Now, next piece. Kofino toliv not la'ir choma udlataim uvriach. We also compel an unwilling, helpful member of our community, an unwilling citizen in this case, now we move to the city level, to help build for a city a surrounding wall, choma, dilataim, the double doors, uvriach, and the crossbar for locking the city's gates. Now we're getting something about city engineering here. So if my city is a city that needs a wall and double doors and a crossbar, I ultimately, what do I know now? That I can compel citizens to participate in the building of that part of my city. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, what do you think he's going to say? Lo chola yarod riyot lechoma. Not every city requires a wall. Okay. So we have it on his authority that not every city requires a wall, but we do have it on his on the Mishnah's authority that we compel people to participate in building a wall, building the double doors, and creating the crossbar. Kami yehe va'ir, v'yehe ka'anshe ha'ir. Now it asks about someone, how long must one live in a city to be considered like one of the citizens of the city? Okay, this is a famous place for participating in
taxation.
The taxation of a place and the voting in a place, if there is voting. We don't really know. We don't really know if there's Senate, but there's at least Shiva B'nei Ha'ir. There's at least seven on the council of the city who are, by the Anshei Ha'ir, by the people of the city, appointed to some leadership capacity to legislate about bureaucratic stuff like this. And building stuff like this. Okay, so we're talking about status here. And so how long does someone have to live there? And the Mishnah answers, Yud Bet Chodesh. 12 months. So if you're in a place for 12 months, then you have to really, you're considered to be one of the people, Anshei Ha'ir, people of the city. Kanava Beit Dira. If you bought a house in the city, though, meaning if you bought a house before the 12-month period of time, Harehu Ch'ancha Ir Miyad. You are exactly like one of the members of the city, immediately meaning that you have a status of Anche Ha'ir, and that if you buy the place, you're basically responsible for taxes, and you're responsible for the citizens' kind of obligations. And obviously, in this case, if we're going with everybody agrees with the Reisha, not Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, you have to participate in building the wall, in building the double doors, and in building the crossbar that keeps it shut.
So my question is, because these two things are linked, does that mean that the wall is also to keep out the poor and to keep out the people who are not?
Well, so far you wouldn't know that from the Mishnah except from our conversation, right, Bobby? The important part about the introduction of this Mishnah is you wouldn't know really it's about tzedakah unless we translated the Beit Sha'ar, the
right.
Gatehouse, as being a wall between you and poor people. Rashi only called those people the people of the general public. I kind of gave away, spilled the beans, to say the Gemara is going to relate to the poor people of the city. But so far, really, in the Mishnah, you wouldn't really know that. Okay. Other questions on the Mishnah before we launch into some Gemara? Okay, Gemara. Here we go. Now, just again to remind everybody, since we're back to a page of Gemara in front of us, if you're looking at the Hebrew page of Gemara, what happens at the beginning of the Talmudic discussion? The Talmud moves you into the Talmudic discussion by putting the letters Gimel and Mem, right? And you think that just stands for Gemara, except that it can stand for Gamarinan. It's a shortened version of Gamarina. We studied this matter. We finished the discussion of this Mishnah as follows. Not really, but Gamar means to finish, so I'm just inserting it here a little bit. But we kept this conversation going this way. Okay. So, the Gemara is now going to talk about the gatehouse. L'memra devet sha'ar ma'al yutahi. Is this really to say that the gatehouse is such a good thing? Ma'al yuta, nice word. Is it a good thing? It's going to bring now a story. Hahu chasidah dehava ragil Eliyahu dehava mishta'e bahade. We have a certain chasidah, a certain pious soul, a chasid. Not wearing what you think a chasid looks like. In today's Brooklyn kind of garb. When it says chasidah in the Gemara, it has nothing to do with the chasidim and the way they look in today's world. Dehava ragil Eliyahu dehava mishta'e bahade. There was a certain pious man with whom Elijah the prophet would regularly visit and discuss matters. Now, this whole notion of Elijah the prophet visiting people and having direct interactions with people of this world is a fantastic trope, a literary trope in the Talmud. Right? Somebody may remember a different place in the Gemara where that happens already. Right? If it comes to you,
well, when they were walking,
right,
the man and the woman, and then somebody stopped.
Right. So we studied in the summer.
Right.
The whole notion of Rabbi Akiva's story.
Then there was
a guy who walked out into the forest and bumped into Eliyahu. So we've had it there in terms of the context of love and the Talmud and marriage. There's also the walking on the very third page of the Gemara, meaning the second page really, page 3 of the Gemara in Brachot. which I brought you the story, we'll get there, of Eliyahu, Elijah, being part of the story about the rabbis walking into the ruins of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple. So hold on for a moment. We'll talk more about Elijah's role, the Elijah trope in the Gemara itself, but let's stay here for now. Okay, so is this to say that a gatehouse is a good thing? There was a certain pious man with whom Elijah would always regularly visit and talk, Avad Beit Shar, the Chassid constructed a gatehouse, v'tulo mishtai bahade, and Elijah wouldn't come and converse with them anymore. All right, so whereas the Mishnah seemed to say that, of course, a Beit Shar, a gatehouse, is an obvious and good thing in a community, what's the force of the story thus far? You know, you do parts of stories and you say, thus far. What do we really hear? This Chassid built a gatehouse and Elijah stopped coming. Okay. So obviously there's a question. Here's the question, and here's the way it pans out. Below Ishtai Bahade, first Rashi on the Gemara. So I'm now on the left-hand side of the page, where it says Gimel Mem in the Rashi. Why did Elijah stop coming to visit after he built this gatehouse? Lefi shemafsik be'oniyim hatsoakin ve'en kolam nishma. Because it stops or puts a hefsek, it puts a barrier between the poor of the town, of the city, or that area, who are tzoakim, who are, how are we going to translate that in this context?
Crying out,
right? We're not going to say screaming.
Crying out.
They're crying out, and their voices are not heard. Now, how does Rashi know that that is how you interpret that part of the Elijah story? Because of what comes later in Gemara.
Well, was Elijah supposed to be poor? Is that part of the characterization of Elijah?
It's a really good question, Bobby.
I wonder whether it was a barrier for Elijah coming.
No, Elijah saw it as a barrier, and he represents the people.
Right, so I understand, but I wonder if that's part of the characterization of who Elijah was. He was.
He ever went to Elijah's cave in Israel?
No.
In Haifa?
Yeah.
He was probably very poor.
Very what?
He was probably very poor.
Yeah, that's the cave that he went up to the sky. So now there is a cable car. So that's the place where he just left the area. That was his departing station.
I mean, he was definitely known as a simple man, a simple prophet. God provided food when he needed food. Right? And remember, he was running away from Jezebel.
So,
sat there. I mean, but the question of whether or not he's really known as to embody the impoverished soul of Israel is a good question. All the recollecting that I'm doing now, as you asked the question, does not point to Elijah being per se representative of the poor, except hold the thought, because there's an interesting connection between your question and where he stands on page 3 of Brachot. Okay? So interesting connection to make. Okay, so look, the Gemara says, you told me this story about Elijah and how Elijah doesn't come anymore, and you're telling me that's because he's condemning the buildup of Beit HaShaar, of this gatehouse, but I'm going to say, what? Lo kashya? It's not such a difficulty. You know, the Mishnah says one thing, the story seems to represent another direction. Not such a difficulty. It's not so illogical. Ha, this gatehouse, mi gavae, was located inside the door of the courtyard. In other words, there's a door of the courtyard, and once you open the door, you get then to the gate. So what? There's a door and a gate in this first one, or this last one. Ha! However, that gatehouse discussed in the Mishnah, the one above, Mi Barae, was constructed outside the door of the courtyard, so did not constitute an additional barrier. Right? So the courtyard has a door, and everybody knows that a door is an obligation, because the Mishnah said, Beit Shaar and Devet. Beit Shaar outside makes logical sense, because then if you're going to come in, you're going to come in. The shomer can hear the person if he's out there. But if there's a door between the shomer, the gatehouse, and there's another gatehouse out there even, right? Well, that's in the Elijah story. Whether there's a gatehouse outside the door and then there's a gatehouse inside the door, I'm not sure exactly. But I could see that you could think either way. You could either say there's a public outside gatehouse, a door, and then and an inside gatehouse even, and that's like three layers. Or you could say there's a door and then a gatehouse, and it seems like that door being to the outside is really a first real barrier. Okay, the Gemara, though, now that you've tried to explain that there's no illogical kind of hitnakshut, there's no
clash,
offers a different explanation. V'i bayit ema ha v'ha mibara'e. If you want to say, though, that both of these, in the story of Elijah and the story of the Mishnah, were outside the courtyard door, lo kashya, it's still not a difficulty. It's still not a problem. Ha de'it le'delet. This gatehouse in the incident had a door which the poor were afraid to open, and therefore they remained behind the double barrier. And the one in the Mishnah had the late lay delit. However, that gatehouse in the Mishnah has no door. Therefore, the poor are able to enter the gatehouse freely and call to the residents through the closed courtyard door. Oh, so wait a minute. Is the gatehouse itself with a unique door? Is that what I'm talking about when it said delit above in the Mishnah? Or is it that there's a door beyond the gatehouse?
I just imagine if the gatehouse is on the outside, the gates can be opened because the attendant sees people. Nobody can come in without permission. So that way the chatzar is open to people who are going by. If you've built your gatehouse on the inside of the gates, the presumption is that the gates are closed and somebody has to knock in order for you to then open the gates for them. So that's why it's... I'm having trouble picturing these because he mentions the possibility of a gatehouse that doesn't have a door. So does that just mean it's sort of just an open enclosure, so there's no need for a door? Is that what he suggests?
Right. So okay. So basically they're muddying the water a little bit about what these structures even are. Does the gatehouse itself have the door that when the shomer in the gatehouse kind of swings it open, then boom, you're right into the courtyard? Or is there some kind of gateway to pass through, and then there's a door? So even though I've checked you out at the gatehouse, and I've said, oh, yeah, yeah, you look like you can go in, then the next step is there's a locked door. It's kind of like, you were so gracious, Mr. Shomer, at the gatehouse. But by the way, now you got to stand there, and now look at how muddy it's going to get in the next two passages, because, do I pull the string to open the door? Do I get to turn the doorknob? Or, by the way, do I just sit there and knock, 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 knock because the doorknob's on the other side of the door? Right? So, in other words, do I make this possible for you or do I not make this possible for you? And really, that's at the core. That's the core part of the conversation. How easy, how accessible, how open, how possible is it for now the poor we're talking about to actually come and have access to the members of this community in order to get a little something to eat, get a little money, ask for a little something, a little help. That really is the issue. And look at how we keep going. Because right now, again, we don't know where the door is and where the gateway is, but they said, no problem. This is how we explain these two stories and the tenor of the two stories where Elijah said, no, I'm not coming to speak with you anymore. Because that's really also what the Gemara is trying to understand, like why Elijah would basically say, no, I'm sorry, you crossed the line. Gemara presents a third difference that could be between the story in the Mishnah and the story that began our Gemara. Ibaidim, if you want to say havaha de'it le'delet, if you want to say that this desirable and that undesirable gatehouse, each one has a door, v'lo kasha, and there's still no difficulty, ha de'it le'potacha, this gatehouse in the Mishnah has a doorknob, so that the paupers are able to open the door and enter, so that the delet, the door that I actually asked you to participate in a wonderful way, could create an access point for the poor because it has the doorknob in the right place. And the one with the Elijah story, what do you think then? That it doesn't have a doorknob. And then I got to sit there and bang on the door. Or, some, you know, it feels very, very closed to me. And that's why Elijah said, ha, the late potachat, this gatehouse in the incident has no doorknob. Then that's really where I could explain the difference between the story in the Gemara and in the Mishnah. And so then the Gemara wants to present another possibility, as if that really wasn't the difference. By the way, could be. If you want to say that this one and that one, the desirable one and the undesirable gatehouse in the story each has a doorknob, I could still tell you, lo kasha, there's no difficulty of understanding the story. Ha defotacha dide migavae, vaha defotacha dide mibarae. The one in the Mishnah had the doorknob on the outside, and it was obvious how you open the door, and it was decent enough, like, you know how some doors, they have a little either handle or the rectangle that says push here. You know how to go in, right? But some doors have the doorknobs or the door pulls on the inside only. And what Elijah was reacting to, according to the end of the passage in this Gemara here, what Elijah's reacting to is that the door that I'm talking about that made me say I'm not coming to talk with you anymore only has the handle on the inside. And that's not acceptable according to this little narrative of the story in the Gemara as compared to the law in the Mishnah. So what do you think?
I think they should have better architects.
They should have better architects.
Well, this section seems to be talking about compelling people to pay for it. If someone wants to pay for it on their own, for everyone, this doesn't seem to be a problem.
Well, let's say that we live in the same courtyard. Okay, we all pay for it. But we've built our door with a doorknob on the inside. Comes along the commentary of this little Maisala story. Elijah the prophet visits with this chassid, this pious soul. We all want to be a chassid, level of chassid. We're all striving to be a chassid.
I may be a little off point. Okay, I understand that it's a community door, and let's just go on from there.
Okay, so the fact is that the story here came to make a commentary on how we decided as members of a community. And if I think that I'm doing the right pious thing, because we want to be good Jews, right? And we built our doorknob on the inside, even though we all pay for it. The commentary here is, Elijah doesn't come talk with us anymore.
So what would they say about a two-man building?
So right, I mean, this is a very interesting kind of thing. at some dormant buildings, most, aren't they trained to be quite welcoming and open the door for people?
That's what people ask me.
But then they call upstairs.
Not for people begging from the street, no. But that's what this is. I think society is a little bit, it's not completely analogous. But
right.
Yeah, they're not welcoming to people who are strangers who don't look quite.
Yeah, even put a sign. Don't put the papers and don't do this.
You have to know someone in the building.
So in that vein, of course, I figured that we would.
There's another level here where if someone walks out on the street and let's assume they're a doorman building, whatever, and someone screams out, "I'm poor, please help me."
They will close the door.
But if you hear it inside,
yeah.
You can interact. You can choose to help them or not.
Right, because you can.
If you're too far removed, you can't
hear it.
Okay, so in terms of a community, can you as a community cut off the poor from your community entirely? Or does there need to be access so at least as
make
a community
a choice.
You hear them? You may have no money, you may have no food, you may not have any of that as a community. But to interact is probably the basic level that I seem to hear coming here. You know they exist, and you have to deal with them as opposed to cutting them off. And at least that's the beginning part in terms of what level you have to help them. That's not even approach, but just, you know, and, you know, in terms of our city,
mm-hmm.
Yes, they're cut off from your building, but there are agencies in the city we live in, so if someone is poor, there is a place they can go to access, and that's sort of where our city has migrated to. It may not work that well, but...
Well, so when you walk by them, you salvage those, right?
You can choose that level. And I believe, to get back to your fundamental question, I believe that we do have to ask ourselves whether or not we think that the agencies that you're referencing now and some of the other systems that we have in place to deal with Oniye Ha'ir, like the poor of the city, really come to answer the question how we keep our gates open to them or not. And that is one of the fundamental questions we're asking in reading these Gemaras and thinking through our obligations as a Jewish community, right? We really do need to ask.
The synagogue store is always open.
It is? No, it's not.
No.
I don't think so. I just had to go down there because it wasn't open. Why do you say that?
Well, if somebody came here on a Shabbat to come into the sanctuary, I don't think that we stop people based upon...
Yeah, but if you want to
As a matter of fact, there's good reason, I mean, and this is all a matter of calculated, some of it is even calculated risk. There are times where we need to say no, because we've had some incidents where we've had some of the real poor of the community come and take advantage and or even provide the sense of a little threat, or whatnot. If they come and they're at the door, generally, we can at different times talk with someone and say, "Are you looking for right now? Are you looking for lunch?"
Yeah.
There are times that I've brought somebody some food from our refrigerator. There are times where we send somebody to which shelter has lunch today. There are times where sometimes I have envelopes. Of double high. If I have, at holiday times, I usually create a couple. And those are the moments where I'm able to say to somebody, "Oh, let me give you this." Or at one point, I also had some grocery carts. So someone could just go and get some food. Generally, people are looking for something to eat, and they come to a synagogue because they think there's a soup kitchen here. Because at some of the churches and some of the local places in this neighborhood, it turns out, you know, that there's a network of pantries. So that's the way I think we can, you know, but we do have
you're
a buzzer.
Listening.
And so in that sense, you could call our buzzer system a HR.
Yeah.
Right. You could call it a gate system.
But you're listening to them.
And we're listening, and we have people here in general, especially during business hours. So we could say we're answering that question, but this question of the system of the modern city as it parallels the Mishnah's expectations is a good question.
Yes.
How much can we take some of the lessons and laws out of Mishnaic text, out of Talmudic text, and then apply them directly to our cities? Rambam, Maimonides, is going to have a lot to say about that in terms of what he codifies in his Hilchot Matanot Levyonim, or Matanot Le'aniim, his gifts and charity to the poor section of his Mishneh Torah, which we're going to look at in more detail once we learn some of the major Gemara pages that deal with the laws of Tzedakah.
I just wanted to add that they don't do what I thought they would do, which is go with, obviously, the gatehouse is an undesirable structure. Instead of offering the idea that since Elijah did not come anymore, that you should not have a gatehouse, they're figuring out where the doorknob is and where everything is because they're really going around to maintain the gatehouse, even though Elijah didn't want it. So I think that they're really going overboard to justify the gatehouse and define the gatehouse and everything rather than saying maybe we shouldn't have a gatehouse.
You're right that there was an open door to say, based on Elijah's Musser here, right?
Yeah.
Musser means the...
They decided to keep him out. Let's put it this way.
Yeah. Based on his teaching, you could have decided that. So that then gets into the question of balance within safety and society and when the poor should be able to come in and when the poor should have their space in place. The answer is not that the gatehouse is necessarily that. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, by the way, remember, said not every city and not every courtyard requires a gatehouse. Perhaps there's some lesson in that to take away as well by way of what he's really talking about. Is it that it's not obligated because the structure doesn't require it? Or was he also talking a little bit about the social engineering of all of this?
But it doesn't say you have to let anyone in. It just says that you have to construct it in a way that you can hear them if they're coming to make a plea.
Right, and that's another piece.
I mean,
but you also have to have a doorknob.
If you hear someone asking for food or money, what should you do?
Well, we're going to get into some of that, definitely.
Well, you know, there's certainly a clear implication that there are certain circumstances in which the gatehouse and door is required, because if it's not required, why would you compel somebody to help pay for something that doesn't have to be there in the first place? And what I don't understand is there's a lot of discussion on what makes something a good gatehouse or a bad gatehouse, but no discussion on when you need to build one in the first place.
Presumably for safety. So I think that's sort of a given here, that if you're going to have this sort of arrangement, you need to have something to secure it. And now the question is, how secure does it have to be relative to still being able to hear the plea of the poor?
Well, what are the factors that enter into, what's the fear of? Are they in a place where attacks are happening frequently?
Yeah.
It's not the poor of the community. There can be, outsiders who are coming
in. Right.
But, what I take away is you can't use security as an excuse for cutting yourself off from the pleas of the poor.
Right. So far, I think that is the trouble. There's a balance between privacy and or security and connection to the poor of the city.
There is a sentence, they're saying that aniyei yilcha kodmim, correct? So they should be always...
That's the Rambam already, and some of the Gemara will get into prioritization and the Rambam then codifying it. But yeah, not here.
Right, okay.
But definitely Rashi brought up the fact of who these people are, right?
So I'm trying to think.
Yeah, he defined the Rishus HaRabim.
In the Mishnah, Onim in the Gemara.
I'm thinking about the contemporary city, and I don't know if they still do it because we're not here that weekend, but for Puerto Rico Day Parade Day, the houses on Fifth Avenue would, construct elaborately barriers around the trees and around the house because there was so much stuff going on for Puerto Rico Day. And I think they've pulled back on it. It used to be really elaborate, and it turned it into like a fortification on Fifth Avenue. So that's a kind of a contemporary analogy to this kind of the not Fifth Avenue people coming to Fifth Avenue and creating this
damage to the property.
Yeah, that's a bit more of an extreme, I think.
Just damage.
Yeah. Were you going to say something, Helene? Yeah. All right. So just before we push on to the next part, which we'll get into a little bit, Judy, of, you know, why Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel said you need it, you don't need it, what's, when's it required, things like this, which may answer some of the kind of questions that you brought up. Let's just talk for a second about Elijah's appearance right away in this Gemara, because, you know, it's, you can't pass up the opportunity to remember Elijah the prophet. Eliyahu Hanavi, Zachor Latov. He's remembered for good, right? That is how he comes to be known in rabbinic literature. And so let me just circulate these.
He's always associated with miracles.
Many times. Here, from that end,
yeah, he
take one and pass it around.
He never died, so that's the story that he reappears all the time.
Okay, so the Elijah stories in the... In Talmudic literature, there's a number of them that I'll make reference to before we look at the one that I've passed around now. First of all, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi meets Elijah while the prophet was standing at the entrance to the cave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and Rabbi Yehoshua asked him, "Do I have a place in the world to come?" And Elijah replied, "If the master desires it." And as Elijah spoke, Rabbi Yehoshua looked about in wonderment. Perhaps it was only the echo from the cave before which he stood, but later on when he would speak of this meeting with Elijah, he would say, "I saw two of us, but I heard the voice of a third." And then he asked about a future time, "When will the Messiah come?" I'm not in the text that you have yet. I'm giving you some other stories before we get to the text that you have. And Rabbi Yehoshua asks Rabbi Elijah, this story appears in Sanhedrin, the one that you've got in your hands from Brachot. And he says, "When will the Messiah come?" And Elijah answers, "Go and ask him yourself." And for those of you who were here, we learned this in Sanhedrin, when we studied Sanhedrin in Perek HaChelek, the 11th chapter of Sanhedrin. Rabbi Yeshua was amazed. "You mean I could find him, talk to him now? Where is he?" Elijah said, "You can find him at the gates of Rome." "How will I recognize him at the gates of Rome?" asked Rabbi Yehoshua. Elijah told him, "There he sits among the lepers, whom you will find unwinding all of their bandages at the same time, and then covering their sores with clean bandages. The Messiah is the only one who unwinds and rewinds his bandages one at a time." Why?
How you do more than one at a time.
Doctor?
Not so easy to do more.
Why?
Than
oh, because he wants to be ready to go as soon as
exactly,
he
exactly. Because if God should say, "Now is the time, Elijah, get up, I mean the Messiah, get up, it's time to go tell the world that Mashiach is here and we need you to teach," then you're going. And so he wants to be ready at a moment's notice if God calls upon him. That's one Elijah story. Then there are stories where Elijah comes disguised as an old man. This is another of the themes of the way that Elijah appears. The young Eleazar, son of the great Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, was determined to make his own way in the world. He would not learn Torah and be a rabbi and teacher. He would make a career in the Roman government, which his father hated. I figure it's a decent night to talk a little bit about government. The fact that his father hates it. At one point, the Romans put Eleazar in charge of animals and laborers who could be rented for trucking and transportation. Elijah ever remembered for the good, Zachor Latov, disguised as an old man, came to him one time and said to him, get a beast of burden ready for me. Eleazar asked, and what do you have to load on the animal? And Elijah said, I have this worn out water skin, my cloak, and myself as rider. Eleazar said to himself, take a look at this old man whom I can pick up and carry to the end of the world, and he says to me, get a beast of burden ready for him. So what did Eleazar do? He put Elijah on his back, took him up the mountainside, and brought him down into valleys across fields of thorns and fields of thistles. Along the way, Elijah began to bear down on him, making himself heavier and heavier. Eleazar said, old man, lighten yourself. If not, I'll throw you off. And Elijah said and asked, would you like to take a few breaths? He replied, yeah. So, what did Eleazar do? He took Elijah to a field where he set him down under a tree, gave him something to eat and drink, and after Elijah ate and drank, he asked Eleazar, what will all this wandering around get you? Would it not be better for you to settle down and take up the trade of your ancestors? And Eleazar asked, can you teach me their occupation? And Elijah replied, yes. There are those who say that Elijah, ever remembered for the good, Zachor Latov, taught him for 13 years until he knew all of Sifra, the great Midrash, the ancient teachings of the book of Leviticus. And once he was able to carry all the Sifra, he could not even carry his own cloak. In other words, he became such a chacham that people would carry everything for him. And just one other before we go to our story on the pages. I'll just tell you quickly. So there's an argument about whether or not people have a place in the world to come. We also saw this when we studied Sanhedrin. We took a detour. And people want to know, and so Elijah comes, and they say, Elijah, bring us to a place where people have a share in the world to come. And Elijah brings them into the middle of a marketplace. This man has a share in the world to come. This man? Who is this man? Ah. He's the local jester. He's the badchan. He makes people laugh. And anybody who's going to make other people laugh, that's a person who has a share in Olam Haba. That's a person who has a share. Okay, so that's a little bit of Elijah in our lives through the stories. And then this story that we're going to have in... you know what? I need one of the copies of the stories. Is there an extra? Can you fly that back around? There's one back. Okay. So we're looking at the story where I have the Magen David, the star over there on 3A2 in English. Tanya was taught in a Braita. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi said, "Pama chad hayiti mehalech baderech." Once I was traveling on the road. ונכנסתי לחורב אחת מחורבות ירושלים להתפלל. And I entered into one of the ruins of Jerusalem to pray. Ba Eliyahu Zachor Latov, Elijah the prophet remembered for good came. I'm on now 3A3 in the packet, left-hand column, after the initial Hebrew page of Gemara. I read at the bottom of 3A2, and now I'm on 3A3. Everybody there? Okay. So Elijah's there. V'shamar li ala petach. And he stood and guarded the gate. In other words, he was outside at the door. And this is Bobby where the connection came to me when you asked the question. Mm-hmm. Is he of the poor of Israel? Well, the poor were at the gate. The lepers were at the gate. So here is Elijah at the gate. He doesn't go in, per se. You know? Maybe because it's the ruins that he doesn't go in. You could say that's the simple sense. Because he's going to ask, what the heck are you doing in the ruins? But it's a nice intertextual moment with your question centering us on where the poor were in Bava Batra and where Elijah is physically here. Yeah. So, v'shamar li al ha-petach, himtin li, he waited for me, ad she-siyamti tfilati. He waited until I finished my prayer. La'achar she-siyamti tfilati, after I finished my prayer, amar li shalom alecha, Rabbi. He said, shalom to you, my teacher. V'amarti lo, and I said to him, shalom alecha, Rabbi Umari. I upped him one. Hello, my teacher, my Rav, my master. Va'amar li, and he says to me, Bini, my son, what reason did you enter the ruin there in Jerusalem? Amarti lo lihitpalel. I said to him to pray. Va'amar li, and he says to me, Hayalach lihitpalel baderech. You could have just said your prayer while you were on your way. Should have prayed on the road. And, in other words, what? Not gone into the ruin that you went into. V'amarti lo, and I said to him, Mityare ha'iti shema yafsiku v'ovdei drachim. But I was afraid for my life that they would come and arrest me and take me away. And they would interrupt me and I would lose kavanah. I would lose intentionality in my prayer. V'amar li, and he says to me, Hayalach lihipalel tefila k'tzara. You could have prayed a shorter abridged prayer. Now, by the way, that's a construct. You see that the footnote says it. We don't really know that what he was referring to exactly what Havinenu is, but there's, in Sidurim, you will find in the Sidur, a shortened form of the Amida, which is a summary of the entire contents of all the 19 blessings within one paragraph of the Amidah itself. Because when you're really on your way and on the road and you really need to pray very quickly and you want to kap mincha, you want to get mincha in before sundown, you need to say something really quickly so that you really have halachic permission to say this shortened version of the prayer. So before continuing to relate the dialogue with Elijah, Rabbi Yossi pauses and says, Ba'ota sha'al amarati mimena shlosha devarim. At that time, I learned from Elijah the following three things. Lamarti she'ein nichnasin lechorva. I learned that, one, you shouldn't go into ruins. Two, v'lamarti she'mitpalim b'derech. I learned that you actually can pray on the road, which I did not know. And three, v'lamarti she'hitpalil b'derech nitpalil tefila kitzara. And when you're praying on the road, you actually have the option of saying a shorter prayer. So three things I learned. Now, just this part alone, and then we'll wrap up. What's really beautiful about the story and the way it's phrased here, which takes us, again, back to our Gemara and the question we need to ask about our Gemara, which we did ask, and we just didn't see what's coming, so we don't know how to answer the question in full yet. But we asked the question naturally as a Chevre Limud, as a learning community tonight here in the Beit Midrash. What did this great Rav, right, who is praying here? Who's the Rav? Rabbi Yossi. Very important rabbi.
Rabbi Yossi.
Yeah, he's a Tana, he's very important. What did he do after encountering Elijah? He had a discussion, and then the Gemara's format is to say, three different times, Lamadati, Lamadati, Lamadati. I learned three things. I learned three things in an affirmative way. I learned three things after reflecting on the encounter with Elijah. I learned three things after the story. And therefore, if I want to do the intertextual work of going from Masechet Brachot, over here where we are in our story, back to Bava Batra, where we learned this evening, I have to say, what am I supposed to do after an Elijah story? Lamadati, Lamadati, Lamadati. I'm supposed to learn something. And that's the way I need to read an Elijah story, and that's the way I need to read the beginnings of that reflective moment in the Gemara post the building of a gatehouse, and the Rashi that said it's about the poor, and therefore we're on our way learning again and reflecting again and learning from Elijah the prophet in our Beit Midrash. That's the question, Ron. Now if you're going to, like, you know, let's get exact. I don't know how many exactly we need to learn, but
no discounts.
Maybe a discount. What, Mayor?
Elijah always associated with learning something from?
always.
There was not
an association necessarily in Bava Batra, but what I'm suggesting, for the sake of our purpose over there, since we're trying to really think about tzedakah, is that you can learn from brachot and the notion that there was a reflective moment for Rabbi Yossi who learned even three times, lamadati, 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 that yes, there is a certain amount of I'm supposed to learn something about this world. And so I think there is an encouragement.
The way you described it, it occurred to me, maybe there are such instances that escaped me in the usual Eliyahu story, but it's included there somewhere, because the way you described it, that it was an immediate result, lamadati, lamadati, lamadati. So does it appear in some other disguise in other Elijah?
Well, sometimes it appears explicitly, is my point, and sometimes it doesn't, but I think that because it's on page 3 of Brachot, it's suggesting that we always need to be thinking ourselves, even if in the Gemaras it doesn't say so. Yeah. All right, we're off and running.
Thank you.
Lamadnu, lamadnu, lamadnu.
Yeah.
We learn, we learn, we learn.
Elijah
is considered a prophet. Elijah is considered
a teacher.
Considered here, you know, Rabbi Umar.